Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lisa Si, whose latest novel is China Dolls. Other novels include Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Dreams of Joy, Shanghai Girls, Peony and Love. There are 9 novels in all. This particular book is historical fiction, takes place in the 1930s and 1940s, mostly in San Francisco, and involves 3 young women in the entertainment business. What brought you to write about the entertainment business in the Chinese world, the Asian world, let's say, let's expand it a little bit, of the West Coast during that particular era?
There were really a couple of things. I'd known about these performers for many, many years, and I meet a lot of people who work in archives or collecting information on Chinese American history in particular. But I also have a website, and there are a lot of people who write to me and send me photographs and little things that they've written about their parents or grandparents or aunts or uncles who were performers, whether they were singers or dancers. And so this had been in the back of my mind for many, many years, maybe even 10 years, that I'd been thinking that it would really be nice to write about this. My last book was Dreams of Joy, and it was very dark. I mean, it was just really dark. You know, if you're killing 45 million people in a famine, it's pretty dark. And by the end of that, I was feeling, I have to say, pretty down. You know, when you're writing, I wish you could just at 5 o'clock say, okay, I'm done, I'm just going to go out and have fun. But it was a pretty dark place for me to be for such a long time. And I also really love Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies and movies from the 30s. And so I actually was spending a lot of time when I was finished with Dreams of Joy just splayed out on the couch watching these movies, kind of trying to heal myself from everything that I'd written before. And so I thought, oh, you know, I really want to be in that. I want to live in that. And in a way, that's what many of those performers themselves were doing, was they saw that kind of fantasy up on the screen and they wanted to be a part of it as well.
Did you, at that point, start looking for Asian performers of that era?
At that point, yes, I did start looking for them, and I knew a fair amount. Anna May Wong was one of my grandfather's very close friends. I actually have some of her clothes. My grandparents and my family owned a shop in Los Angeles Chinatown that lent props to the movies, from the silent films all the way to today. And I knew a lot of people growing up who had been extras or very small parts in films. So I knew the kind of Hollywood aspect of it. But this is so different. These are people who are singers and dancers that really didn't get a big shot in the films. I mean, you can find them. And if you go on YouTube, you can find many of these performers and see these little clips. I've actually gathered a lot of them and put them on my website, so it's sort of one-stop shopping. And you can see how incredibly talented they were. But as it was for Asian American performers, Latino American performers, African American performers, those roles were so limited in film, you know, just so limited. And if you have a lot of talent, you have, you know, and if you're a singer, if you're a dancer, if you're a performer, you want to perform. And so these clubs that were in San Francisco in particular gave a show place for those people.
And Forbidden City, which is one of the main sets of China Dolls, was a real place.
Yes.
And how did you find out about the nightclubs in San Francisco? You knew you wanted to work on this. Had you heard of Forbidden City Charlie Lowe at that point?
Right. Forbidden City was a very famous nightclub. It's the first Chinese-American nightclub outside of a Chinatown anywhere in the world. So, certainly anywhere in the United States.
Where in San Francisco was it?
It was on Sutter Street. Okay. It's near that where that tunnel is.
Just outside of Chinatown.
Right.
But not in Chinatown.
Right. So there were many clubs inside Chinatown, but this was the first one to be outside. And, Charlie Lowe was a very interesting man. His father had died when he was very young, from the age of 8. He supported his mother, you know, doing hauling. They lived in Utah or someplace like that. I can't remember right now. But he made and lost many fortunes. He actually became an avid polo player and, you know, won more polo matches, the only Asian American to win some polo stuff. And he decided to open this club. I think, like many of those club owners, obviously they wanted to make money. You know, obviously they wanted to make money. But they also wanted to provide a show place for performers who didn't have another place to go. And at the same time, I think they were all kind of playing with these Chinese stereotypes at that time. You know, Chinese can't dance. They don't have a sense of humor. They have bow legs. And so many of the acts would start where the Chinese, you know, let's say the chorus girls come out in very traditional Chinese dress. They have their very little, you know, their demure attitude. And a few bars into the music, they'd rip all of that off. And then underneath would be the fishnet stockings and the little corset. They'd throw on a top hat. And it looked like any other chorus line that you could see anywhere all the way to today. It was also a way, I think, to take what seemed to be exotic, you know, these exotic girls, and actually show how absolutely American they were. And that, to me, is the part that, you know, where the audience, with their minds would just be blown. It's like, oh, who could believe that a Chinese girl can do that?
So once you realize that, and that came to the fore, that's the invention of Grace Lee, the character from the Midwest, mm-hmm. who is the most American,
right?
Even down to the fact where she doesn't even know Chinese food.
Right. And actually, I would say the closest to the majority of the men and women who performed in those days, most of them had come from small towns in the Midwest, you know, anywhere far where they were isolated from Chinese culture, Chinese traditions, Chinese customs. I mean, even far, you know, 1938 could be Petaluma, Visalia. A lot of girls came from towns like that, not that far away, but could have been a million miles away in 1938.
Well, there was also the idea of assimilation, which you bring up in
China
Dolls.
Right, and these were, you know, and obviously these girls and young men would have had parents who had deliberately broken away, you know, had really broken away from Chinatown, broken away from those traditions, and had gone to a place where they could be or try to be the reddest, whitest, and bluest.
Lisa C., you create these three characters, all of whom talk in the first person. What brought you to doing this triptych?
At first, the entire novel was going to be from Grace's point of view, the girl who comes from the Midwest. But Helen and Ruby, Helen is from Chinatown. I was looking at her and thinking, what would the circumstances have been for a family in Chinatown to allow their daughter to dance in a club? I mean, as far as I know, there weren't any. But what would the circumstances have been? What would she have had to have done? What could have been done to her that would allow them to do that? And then Ruby is Japanese, masquerading as Chinese, so she can go dance.
And how did you find out about that? Just because of Jack Sue, when you suddenly said, aha?
There were many performers, actually, who were Japanese, Filipino, even Latino, who, again, couldn't get jobs elsewhere and would pretend to be Chinese so they could dance in these Chinese clubs. So they would change their names. And for some of them, like Dorothy Toy, who was the original and still probably the most famous of the Chinese Ginger Rogers. There were many people who claim that, but she really is the one. She's still alive. She lives in Oakland. She's 97. But when she first started, she looked at the marquee and she thought her name, her Japanese name, would look too long, so she shortened it to Toy. And so she's one. There was a woman, Trudy Long, I met, who also was Japanese, who changed her name. As you say, Jack Su, Goro Suzuki, he was a very popular comedian in these clubs doing stand-up. And after he was sent to Topaz, internment camp, he got permission to leave the camp and go to places like Indianapolis, Detroit, Chicago, and do his act. But he knew that to do that, he would have to change his name, and he changed it to a Chinese-sounding name.
When you had all those elements, it became clear, I guess, that this was going to take place during World War II, because that ups the ante in terms of Japanese pretending to be Chinese. And then you decided to begin it with the Treasure Island Fair. Why did you do that?
These clubs really started in 1938, lasted to about 1970, so there was any time period that I could have chosen. But I chose that first decade because it's the end of the Depression, World War II, and then the introduction of television into our homes in a big way. And in this single decade, you know, so much changes in our country, in the West, San Francisco for Chinese Americans. We start to look at each other differently. We start to look at the outside world differently. We start to eat differently, dress differently. And, of course, we start to spend our free time very differently. Nightclubs die and television becomes king. So that decade seemed really important to me. And then the reason I started with the exhibition on the fair on Treasure Island is that this really was the reason that these clubs started. So, you know, here you have the Second World's Fair in San Francisco, and they took a very different approach to it, that they would only invite countries that dotted the edge of the Pacific Ocean. And it's the first time that the phrase Pacific Rim was ever used, actually. And so you had on, all of the pavilions and the gayway, which was more of a carnival atmosphere. And the whole city was preparing for this, did a kind of cleanup project because they were expecting people who were coming from around the world and across the country to come and work at the fair, but also tourists who were coming from around the world and across the country to come and see the fair. And so, you know, like cities do, if they're even today, they're sprucing up for the Olympics or World Cup or whatever it is, they get everything gets spruced up and cleaned up, and Chinatown was part of that. They had what was called the Shine for 39 campaign to eliminate or try to erase some of these old stereotypes. Most of them were gone already that people had about Chinatown, you know, prostitution, opium, gambling. And part of that meant opening up nightclubs and things where people, tourists, could come and be part of this, give them something to do during the fair. So since that fair actually is was the impetus for people to open the clubs, it made a lot of sense because it's sort of the base of what caused everything. And I wanted Grace to come out to that. And you know, it's not giving too much away to say that she doesn't get a job at the fair, but she does get a job at the Forbidden City.
And that's where you have the three main characters come together. Lisa C., in your research, you discovered a lot of slang, and you worked very hard to get the language correct.
Mm-hmm.
A phrase like checking out, meaning dying, I would have thought didn't go back that far, but you say it did.
Yes, I checked all of that. I have two big volumes of about slang that are almost like dictionaries, and you can look up any phrase starts at A, goes to Z. They tell you in those, you know, when the first usage was, and then also like different movies, different books, different places that it's appeared and how that word or phrase may have changed over. Sometimes it's 10 years, sometimes it's 400 years. It's amazing to me how much of the slang that we use even today really comes from Shakespeare's time. Unbelievable amount. And it's really so much older than we think. And, of course, I have a copy editor who's checking all of that. And there was only one piece of slang that I was off by like 5 years. I can't remember what it was, but it was something I thought, oh, that can't be right. But she, when I went and double-checked it, yes, she was.
That meant that since you were working so hard to get all the facts correct, that pretty much everything, the music, when people went to different plays.
Clothes. I've never written so much about clothing in any of my books, but since it actually was so much a part of what was going on at that time and shortages and, you know, pamphlets on how to change your man suit, your man who's off fighting somewhere, how to change your man suit into a woman's suit.
And makeup.
And makeup. A lot about makeup, because partly a lot of the people that I interviewed, you know, these were people in their 80s, 90s, would talk about how they would get together and they would make their own false eyelashes. And how interesting that is I don't know, you probably don't wear false eyelashes, but that to wrap them around your, you know, take some of your own hair, wrap it around your finger, glue it onto something, how you'd curl it. And that's just fascinating to me that people did that.
You're listening to an interview with Lisa C., whose latest novel is China Dolls. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Is there anything that surprised you, just more than even, you know, slang that goes back, anything that, when you read it, you said, wow.
I think the thing that may have surprised me the most, or actually became one of those details that's true, but you think, oh, I don't even know how I can use it because fact is stranger than fiction, was I interviewed a woman named Mai Tai Singh. And I asked her at one point, what was your favorite costume in all the years that you performed? She said, oh, that's easy. It was a gown made out of 15 yards of monkey fur. You know, I couldn't make that up. That's the kind of fact that today, you know, it's so politically incorrect. Well, I think the other one that was really big for me was right after Pearl Harbor, the coverage in Time and in Life magazines, and these drawings. They had almost identical articles with these drawings of a man with arrows pointing at different parts of his body. And one of them, I think it's Life, said, this is a rough quote, but that they were encouraging their readers to be willing to consider the delicate question of how to tell the difference between a Chinese and a Japanese. And so these arrows would point at these differences. Chinese can only grow to 5'5", but a Japanese can top out at 5'2", and Chinese can't grow much hair on his chest, but you can tell a Japanese because he can grow a mustache. Chinese has parchment yellow skin, kind of lovely, but a Japanese is identifiable by earthy yellow skin, something not as nice. And that the Chinese, who, you know, for decades had been labeled inscrutable, now you could tell a Chinese by their placid, kindly expressions, while a Japanese could always be counted to laugh at exactly the wrong moment.
One of the more interesting elements was the story of the Japanese who were forced, because of circumstance, to pretend to be Chinese and what happened when they were caught. Based upon China dolls, it must have been pretty common. If anybody could get away with it, they would.
Yes, if you could get away with it, you would try. But it wasn't very common, actually. I mean, you know, somebody like the Chinese Ginger Rogers, she'd already been the Chinese Ginger Rogers for many, many, many years. So when World War II came along, she knew she was Japanese, but that doesn't mean other people knew she was Japanese, or certainly not the public didn't know that she was Japanese. And it was one of her friends who eventually ratted her out.
Were there a lot of Japanese who were spies?
There is some evidence that there were people who were in Hawaii, that there were some who probably were on the West Coast, but it's always easy in the moment and in the time after a disaster, like, you know, a horrible thing like Pearl Harbor or 9/11, to suspect the people who are here who have nothing to do. I mean, I'm not saying it's right, but we've seen it before, and I'm sure we'll see it again. So that's one of those things that you can accuse people of, whether it's true or not. You know, where the Japanese Americans who were here, whether they were born here, so citizens, or whether they had lived here for a long time and had chosen to make this their home even though they hadn't become citizens, did that mean that they were loyal to Japan? I don't think that, you know, there were some who were.
Right.
And there were some who chose to go home after the war. But the majority of the people who were here were totally innocent, just as the majority of people who were of German descent in America were totally innocent. I live in Los Angeles, yeah. And there was a very large Italian-American community there, and a building called the Italian Hall, which was the big social gathering place, you know, for weddings. They'd had opera programs, dances, bicycle races. And when the war broke out, it had to close down because Italian-Americans were no longer allowed to meet in a group. That's very different than being sent to an internment camp, but it is a way to separate the community and break up the community and the way that people like to gather.
Lisa C., in doing your research, we know a lot about racism toward African Americans. We don't know that much about racism toward Asians, but there were miscegenation laws.
Not only miscegenation laws, but yes, we had miscegenation laws that were specific to Chinese. In 28 states, in California, it was overturned in 1952. But in Washington State, for example, you know, where I think of it as being very, very Asian today, that law wasn't overturned there until 1965. But we had other laws. You know, Chinese down to a quarter couldn't own property in this state till 1952. You couldn't become a naturalized citizen until 1943. There were, you know, laws that tax Chinese-owned businesses like a laundry very differently than if you were a white person who had a laundry. I think as Americans, we don't like to look back at things that are negative. You know, when I was a girl, what I learned about the Chinese in America was only that they worked on the railroad. And that was it. That's all I learned. And so really, for me, a lot of what I've been doing for these 9 books is trying to find that history and make it something that people know about. I had never heard of the Exclusion Act. You know, just myself, I'd never heard of it. I'm surprised how many people I meet in San Francisco who may know that Angel Island is out there in the bay, but have no idea that there was the immigration station there, the Ellis Island of the West. So this is something that seems quite wrong to me, because while the Chinese were not the only group to suffer in this country or to have hardship in this country, I think the more that we know about African Americans, Irish Americans, Italian Americans, you know, fill in the Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, now today you could say people who came from the Middle East. You know, we need to know about what people have gone through, and hopefully that we won't make the same mistakes again.
Lisa C., what do you think that fiction can teach us in these areas that maybe nonfiction can't?
I'll tell you what I think, mainly, is that if you think about all the books that have been written about the Holocaust, for example, what's the one book? Thousands and thousands of books, right? But what's the one book we all remember? The Diary of Anne Frank, One Girl and Her Family. We tend to learn history in terms of wars and dates, but history is about real people. It's about, you know, do you rise to the occasion? Do you fail? Do you succeed? Do you do right by your family? And you can do that in fiction. And the other part about fiction, different people take different approaches to historical fiction. I try to be as true as I possibly can, is that in real life, we don't choose those moments of history that are going to affect us. And so for these characters, they, you know, they don't know what's coming. We know in hindsight what's coming, but they don't know what's coming. And all of us, you know, our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, even us right now, we're living in history. And so if you can take that history and put, in this case, fictional characters, maybe people will turn the pages because they want to know what's going to happen to Ruby and Grace and Helen, and, you know, who's going to get Joe in the end? Are there going to be a happy end? You know, what's going to happen? And the sense of a plot, right, that keeps people turning the pages, but along the way they can learn a tremendous amount, where maybe they wouldn't want to sit down necessarily and read a nonfiction book about the subject.
What do you take away from your early writing of mysteries that you can apply in books like China Dolls?
Clues. The importance of clues and the how you lay them in, and how, and also pacing. The pacing of a mystery is very different than a standard novel. I'm not the right person to ask, actually, but I like to think that my novels do have that kind of page-turning quality. And I think that the only way that I've been able to get to that, I mean, I'm so grateful that I wrote those mysteries, because that taught me so much about how to pace, what you need to lay in, how you build and then come down and build and then come back down again. You know, there's a lot of contemporary fiction that just sort of floats along, and I love that. You know, I love it. I read it, but I personally kind of think it's fun to have where you just have to know what's going to happen next.
How much of that is internalized at this point?
I don't know how much of it's internalized. I think I have to work at it pretty hard, actually.
Really?
I mean, I wish I could say, oh, yes, it just comes really naturally. But I think that's one of the hard parts about writing is how to get that pacing to be just right. It's like making a sauce, you know. You just have to get it just right, or else it will curdle or it won't hold together properly.
Lisa C., one question I've been asking a lot of authors recently concerns the idea that a character takes over or they do what they want to do. And some people give me, you know, answers ranging from, oh, it happens, to it never happens. For you, how much control in that sense do you have? And do characters take over? And if they do, what does that mean?
Well, I have a very good example with China Dolls, which is that I wrote the entire first draft completely from Grace's point of view. But when I went back to page one, there were places where Helen and Ruby, they were just like screaming at me, I want to say something here. In my head, they were like, wait, you know, and I could hear Helen, you know, she has these aphorisms she uses, and it hadn't been in the manuscript, but she was just like in my head telling me what to do. And Ruby, of course, well, she's, you know, she has her own way of speaking, which is so unlike my way of speaking that it was really very odd to have her in my head and be so persistent. So I actually went back to page one and I looked at those places where one of those other people were just like screaming to be, I need to tell this story at this point now. Thank you very much. And so they really did take over. They really forced themselves into the book.
So at that point, you rewrote those sections from those
points
of view.
I started over at page one and went all the way through and changed, basically the whole novel.
There's a chapter when Ruby is in a relocation camp, and that chapter is primarily...
And right, and see, I didn't even have that in the first draft, right? Because how could Grace have known about that? And so that was one of the places where Ruby, you know, when I got to the end, she was like, yeah, but they don't know what I went through. People don't know what I went through. And it was true. The reader would not have known what she went through. She could have recounted it, but you wouldn't have internalized it as a reader in the same way.
In that sense, it removes necessary exposition and puts you in the place.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. I mean, there is that practical result of it, and I think that is a better result. But I have to say, I wasn't thinking about the practical aspect that you've just mentioned. It was more that these were very strong voices in my head that really were demanding to be heard. I know that makes me sound like Sybil. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of scary, but it's true that they have this very strong sense of what they want to do. Now, that said, I had these, let's call them signposts along the way, where I know I want to write about this. I want, you know, I know Pearl Harbor. I know the opening of the exposition. I know Pearl Harbor. I know the date that internment begins. I knew that I wanted Grace to go to Hollywood for a while. I knew that I wanted to end at the China Doll in New York. So I know these places that I'm going to, but I don't necessarily know how I'm going to get from here to that first signpost or the next one to the next one. And to me, that is where the characters... So I am in control in that sense, but then the characters do kind of take over and say, okay, this I don't know what you're thinking about how I'm going to get there, but here's what I'm thinking about how I'm going to get there.
That's very different from some writers who talk about almost as if it would help them to do an acting class because they become the characters. In this case, the characters are speaking to you.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one thing with the character of Helen. Once I realized that I was going to now write some chapters from her point of view, I started each of her, I think every chapter that's her chapter, with an aphorism. And just like I've been collecting slang, I also have, you know, for probably 25 years have been collecting Chinese aphorisms, and I have various books and things in notebooks that I've been collecting. And so I would go through until I found the right aphorism that I thought would set the tone for her. And once she had the right aphorism, then the rest of the chapter just grew from that.
But that creates another issue involving these characters, whereas With Grace, she's straightforward. The other ones are less straightforward, and on some level, they're not as reliable as narrators.
That's right. But the unreliable narrator, that's a time-worn tradition.
That means that when you're writing from those point of view, you have to be very careful because you can't give away those mysteries.
When you meet someone, they don't tell you everything about them right off the bat. You sometimes have to peel layers off, and sometimes you get to the truth of them, and sometimes they still withhold from you. I mean, even if it's someone that you're most intimate with, they will keep things from you and can keep things from you forever. To me, that doesn't seem all that strange. I mean, yes, it makes them unreliable narrators, but to me it makes them very real and very human.
Lisa C., on your website, you talk about people, how do you write? What process? And you came up with an interesting idea, which is, and I'm curious if you wrote this that way, get up in the morning, write 4 pages, and until you're done with the book, don't go back.
That's what I do. I write, and I knew partway through that these other characters were demanding to be heard, but I did write all the way through to the end. I write the last sentence first. So I'm always working emotion. I don't know how I'm going to get to that last sentence, but I write the last sentence first because that, to me, is the emotional place where I want to end, just the emotional place of where I want to be. I don't even know what that scene is going to be. I just know the emotional place that I want to be. And there are so many writers, they make the first sentence perfect and the first paragraph perfect, the first page, the first chapter perfect. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just one way. That's just one style. But I like to go all the way to the end because there is a kind of magic that happens. I don't understand it, but I don't know if it's just the subconscious or if it really truly is magic or it is these people in my head who are talking. But there are things that happen along the way that I didn't predict, that I didn't that I don't think I imagined, that happen and are miraculous and interesting. And I think for me, if I was trying to make each page perfect before I went on, I would lose that process.
Well, what about if you hit a place where you're going, oh, damn, I don't know anything about this. Do you stop at that point and go back and go, where is the relocation camp? Let's say you didn't know that.
I knew that there was going to be a relocation camp in this book, and so I did a lot of research about which one it would be. And I was looking at things like where it would be in the West, and I wanted it to be relatively close to Los Angeles. So, that eliminates quite a few of them. I wanted it to be more of a desert where they had dust storms and things like that, where it would be quite harsh environment. So that eliminates some of the others. There were many camps that I could have chosen, but it's in that research that you start to eliminate, and then one becomes, this is clearly the one that I need to use.
Did you always know Grace was going to spend some time in Los Angeles?
I did know Grace was going to spend time in Los Angeles because I wanted to bring in that part of history about how these performers really couldn't make it in Hollywood.
Same thing with the chop suey circuit.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the parts of that era that I think is so kind of fun and interesting, that when performers went out, and actually that chop suey circuit is a phrase that has been used more in a modern way to describe what people did. They didn't use it in the time, but it is so descriptive. But they didn't say we're going out on the Borscht Belt or we're going out on the Chitlin Circuit. They had their own circuit, which came to be called the Chop Suey Circuit. And I interviewed people who went out and did that, but also the children of some of the performers who had traveled with their parents, in the back seat or on the train and carrying all the trunks and living out of suitcases, and what that was like for them. And especially, I'm coming back to Dorothy Toy again, when she was caught by the FBI and the War Relocation Authority, because she was famous, they said, we're going to give you a choice. either we'll send you to your family in an internment camp or you have to leave the state. And so she spent the rest of the war traveling through the South with her sister, who was a singer, and they would go club to club. And she said to me, you know, they'd never seen a Chinese. They'd never seen a Japanese. They didn't know the difference. We knew we'd be safe there.
That also brings up something I didn't know, which is that over time, even though people were first put in the camps, over time most of them got out before the war ended.
Well, not most of them, but a lot of people did. And it started pretty simply with just people in the camp getting jobs working for farmers, you know, working in the beet fields, harvesting corn, things like that, just very locally. And then if you could get a sponsor, couldn't be in the West, had to be further east. If you could get a sponsor, then they would let you go out. And there were many church groups, for example, in New England that sponsored women in particular to come and live in their towns and work as a secretary or file clerk, things like that. And then people like Goro Suzuki, who was the comedian who was able to go out and actually work in nightclubs.
Lisa C., you went to China with Amy Tan. She was doing research for her most recent book,
The Valley of Amazement, and I was doing research for Dreams of Joy. And so we both went to the same village, Huangshan Village, and stayed in this 17th century villa, 29-bedroom villa was how it was advertised to us. This was something that someone had invited Amy to go there, and she asked if I wanted to come with her. And when we were there, the village was in two halves, and we were up in the upper village, and it turned out that the upper village had the name Moon Pond Village. And I said to Amy, are you going to use that? Do you want to use that? And she said, yes, I'm going to use that. So she did use it in the Valley of Amazement. I think it's kind of sad that both of us used that village. It's a beautiful place, really a beautiful place. That house was fantastic. Freezing cold, no glass on the windows and no heating and no hot water, no indoor plumbing. It was pretty tough out there, but it was beautiful. And the people were so generous and open and kind. And yet we both wrote in a pretty negative way about, you know, for our characters about what happens in the fictional village that's based on Huangshan.
Lisa C., do you think a novelist has any political or social responsibility?
There are a lot of novels that don't have any of that in them, you know, so it doesn't even pertain. But I do think if you're writing about, you know, difficult times, things like World War II, the Depression, internment, other things more contemporary, the environment, throw in gun control. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are very important to us, whether they happened in the past or happen today. And, of course, everybody has the right to write whatever they want and to say whatever they want. But I think if you are going to write about those periods or those issues, you better be pretty clear on your facts. You know, hopefully that you can have a conscience and can be responsible in how you talk about those issues.
What are you working on now?
I've just returned from China. I was in Yunnan province up in the ancient tea mountains. This is where the birthplace of tea. So I can tell you three elements to the story. It's going to have stuff about tea. That's a big hint. Also a little baby that has been given up for adoption and comes here to the United States. So the girl and a mother in China and a mother here in the U.S., and then this idea of Chinese fox spirits. And fox spirits are usually young women who can be, well, they can be naughty or nice.
And what is the era?
Right now, but it's going to have a section that goes back 3,500 years.
At this point, I mean, a lot of writers are very hesitant because they're not sure. Maybe they'll hit a dead end. But for you at this point, you know you're going to write that first draft, and then you're going to look at it and go, now what? And you might rewrite it.
Right, and I might rewrite it or I might change things. But, I do know those three elements, how it all pieces together. And, you know, I know who the three main characters are. I know who the secondary characters are. It's something I've been thinking about for quite a long time. The stuff about fox spirits, I've actually been reading and collecting material on that for about 4 or 5 years now. I mean, I tend to think about books for a very long time before I commit to them. And while I'm doing other projects, I can start doing research and start talking to people. And I've been doing that now for, almost 2 years for the next book.
And that was even while you were finishing up on
right.
China
so
Jones.
Right. So I'm writing that one, but just starting to, just doing research. And you know, when you buy a new car, let's say you bought a green Toyota. I once had a green Toyota. And all of a sudden you're driving, and everywhere you look, there's a green Toyota. Well, I think that also happens when you're writing. It's like you've put out into the universe something. I want to write about pu'er tea, which is this one particular tea. And all of a sudden people start popping up around you, the green Toyota effect. And so, when they pop up, I want to take advantage of them while I can. And one of them, after I met with her and we had done a tea tasting, and she, at the end, I said, well, you know so much about this, and I'm going to Yunnan, and I would love it if there's anyone you could introduce me to, farmers or growers or processors. And she said, and I had already sort of planned out my trip, and she said, oh, I'm going in March. Why don't you just come with me? And so I went with someone who was actually in the business of the very thing that I want this book to be about. And we spent time with people I don't think I could have ever have met otherwise.
You've been listening to an interview with Lisa Tse, whose latest novel is China Dolls. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.